week of December 16th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 432, the podcast that brings you all the dirt making news around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on the streets of New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you on the streets of New York?
Well, I'm just, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I'm just, working around and trying. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much. God bless you. It's been a rough couple of weeks. Thank you, sir. It's been a rough couple of weeks. If you may recall, before your vacation or whatever that was, I made a bit of a bet.
Okay.
On the Game Awards, we knew that Red Dead Redemption 2 was going to win the top award. Without a doubt. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Money. And so, you know, we knew it was going to win, and it was looking great.
Wait a second. Do you have people, like, giving you money? Are you begging?
I've got a cup out. I must admit, I have a cup out. And, I went to the awards. I decided to take a risk. A little bit of a risk and bet on the awards, and it was going great. You know, thank you, ma'am. Thank you. God bless you. And it was going great. Red Dead Redemption 2, it won best performance, best narrative, best sound, best score. It was sweeping all the early technical awards, you know, just like at the Oscars. You could feel the momentum building. God, thank you, ma'am. Thank you. And so, you know, I was very excited. And then God of War won best director. And I thought, well, okay, you know, they're splitting the final. Thank you. They're splitting the final. And then God of War won best game.
What? How is that even possible?
It won best director and best game. Who knew gamers were auteurs? I had no idea. I mean, son of a... So my kids' college fund is a little low, and I'm just trying to make up before anybody notices what I've done.
Okay, first of all, how is that even possible when... It
was the greatest game of all time.
I see people on Instagram, they've got their, like, Red Dead Redemption characters, like, screenshots from the game. It's just unbelievable
God of War got great reviews, too. It really revitalized that storyline of that game. And it just goes to show, when you don't follow an industry really closely, you can get very easily, thank you, confused about what's going on. And you really... You know, that's why we follow the film industry and the entertainment business, and we're on top of it. And we get annoyed when people from outside write a little article and they get all the information wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. So, you know, it helps to be aware. And we said up front, look, we don't really follow the game industry that well. A lot of data isn't available. We don't play these games. So, you know, that's what happens when you're an outsider. So it pays to be informed.
Now, okay, number one, I would say I would hate to be, like, at the after party for Red Dead Redemption after that, number one. Number two, speaking of being an outsider, so I was an outsider in Hong Kong, okay, mm-hmm. over at the, at CineAsia, and the last night there, seriously, put the cup away. last night, I'm packing up, heading home, and I got so tired of watching BBC and watching Theresa May talk about how she was
Brexiting
and then wasn't going to be, I don't know. There was all this hoopla with the politics. I was like, okay, I can't take it anymore. But all of the other channels were in, well, not my language. Okay. Not English, which, let's face it. English is, while a predominant language, it's still not the only language in the world. And I was flipping through the channels.
The things you learn when you travel.
Yeah, I reached a channel, and it looked like an award show, and it did not look like it was live. It looked like it was, you know, maybe, recent, but not live. And it was the 2018 MAMA Awards, or as I went in my head, I went, what the heck are those? Okay, it's the Mnet Asian Music Awards. Okay, this is a huge South Korean music awards ceremony, and it's like
the K-pop awards of the year.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be K-pop, but it turns out to be K-pop. Okay, it started in 1999, and in 2017, this awards ceremony, it expanded over 4 nights. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, we think that
the Oscars take a long time.
Four hours. 4 nights, this thing. But, you know, they now have more than South Korea. It's Vietnam and Japan and China. And it's been held in Hong Kong for many years and, you know, at least portions of it. And this year, unbeknownst to me, it was being held in Hong Kong the very night I was leaving the next day. And I'm watching this. Of course, I don't understand a word that is being said, except for Artist of the Year. Okay, I did understand that. And so they were presenting Artist of the Year, and they mentioned all...
They said it in English?
Yes. I said the same thing. I was like, wait, you said all of this in a language I do not understand. And then when it came to the actual name of the category, it's in English. Okay. Huh. Okay, fine. And then when they, you know, do the announcer talk, it was in English too. Like,
interesting, because like you're figuring Vietnamese, Mandarin, other languages, Korean, this is the common business language, and that's why they're using it for the ceremony.
I don't know, but they mentioned, you know, they kind of went through the nominees, and there were all of these different acts named. BTS was one of them, and I went, oh, wait, BTS, we've kind of covered them on Showbiz Sandbox. I kind of know them. Well, lo and behold, they win. Artist of the Year, and they get up on stage, all 920 of them. I mean, it seems like there's like 70 people in this band, and they proceed to have, I swear it must have been a 15-minute speech, and the guy's crying, and I'm like, oh my God, where is the band to play these people off? And there's all these people screaming like they're the Beatles, and I'm just thinking, I don't understand a word they're saying, but obviously he's very emotional about it. And they let the first guy speak, and it took him forever, and he was like bawling and crying, and okay, fine, he's very emotional about it. He just won a big award. But then they let like the second and third guy go, and I'm like, you know, there's like 70 of these people up there. I hope you're not going to let all of them talk. And they just kept going and going. I turned it off eventually.
Wow.
Okay.
So they may have all spoken?
I have no idea. I'll be honest. I've got no idea. There was a lot of screaming going on. I will say that. But that's not the reason I'm telling you this story. Okay. The reason I'm telling you this story is the very next day, I went to the Hong Kong airport to head home. And I am in Terminal 1, which is, I mean, to walk from one end of it to the other, it could easily take 40 minutes. And I'm just at gate number 1, turning down this long hallway of, you know, I think it's like 200 gates. It's a ridiculous number of gates. And I've just turned and I'm walking down this hallway. I realize, boy, this is going to be a long walk. And just as I think that, I hear, what is that rumbling and all of that screaming? And I turn around. And I swear I felt like Harrison Ford in Raiders of the Lost Ark seeing that big giant ball rolling toward him at the very beginning of that movie. Because behind me, I see a throng of people careening toward me. And I am just, and all of these people have their phones out, they're screaming at the top of their lungs, and there's no place for me to go at all. I can't go to the left, I can't go to the right, and they just come at me. And within 10 seconds, I see there's all of these police officers and guards, they all have their arms interlocked, and they're holding hands so that nobody can get at whoever is in the middle of this scrum.
It's Jin.
And literally, they must have looked at me and said, scared white guy without a phone, raising his phone, he could care less about these people. The front guards raise their arms as they reach me. And all of a sudden,
fold you.
I'm in the middle of this throng. I'm like surrounded by all of these people who are screaming and shouting. And I'm like, what the hell is
going
on?
Oh, you're not with BTS? Uh-huh.
And I turn around and I look and I'm like, oh, wait a second. I recognize you with the fuchsia hair. You're BTS. Like the whole time. And I just turn and I look. I must have had like this like deer caught in headlight look on my face. Okay. Because one of them who was one of the people who talked just turned to me and he said, just keep walking. And I just turned around and I just started walking in their direction. And eventually I kind of started walking slower and slower and they just kept passing me by. And eventually I worked my way out of the rear of this. There must have been 700 people. And I wish I was exaggerating, but I honestly thought to myself, this must be what it felt like to be one of the Beatles, like in the midst of all of that. So I have some new friends, BTS.
Jin, Suga, J-Hope. I don't know. I forget which one has the fuchsia hair.
I don't know, but
maybe it's RM. He's the rapper.
I did not realize that the awards ceremony, A, was live, B, taking place in Hong Kong, and C, the very next day, I'd be like somehow trampled by BTS.
Oh, that was probably V. I think V has the red hair.
I have no idea.
Well, you know, you got to learn these things. Well, very exciting. You know, BTS did win the big award, Act of the Year, won a one, nabbed Best Male Act, and twice won Best Female Act, which made me think, hey, do they have K-pop groups ever have guys and girls together? Yes, they do. Co-ed school. They were a big act like 10 years ago. But anyway, that's what you learned when you were in Asia. And this is why our show is 4 hours long. What are we going to learn on the show this week?
It could be 4 days long, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
This week on Showbiz Sandbox, I'm back from vacation. I was working. Didn't you? I was working. Well, anyway, we're ready to catch up on the latest entertainment news. Remember, we'll be spending next week with our families, but we'll be thinking of you and planning one more episode to deliver on New Year's Eve. In movie news, we're headed for a record annual box office, and Disney is actually, they're already there, pulling in $7 billion worldwide. And that's before a very popular nanny makes her return. The Landmark chain was bought by a movie buff, and Luc Besson's company is being dismembered and sold off piece by piece. Michael, maybe with some of that newfound money, you can, you know, buy a part of it.
Good idea.
But that big, the big news in the movie world is it's award season, with all sorts of groups weighing in on their favorites, including the LA Film Critics Association, the Golden Globes, and the first awards that matter, the Screen Actors Guild. Spoiler alert, Roma, Alfonso Cuarón's movie, yeah, it just hit a roadblock. In the Middle Kingdom, China is not done building movie screens, and Marvel saw how well Aquaman did at the box office there and decided to greenlight its first Asian superhero movie. How do you say Black Panther in Mandarin? I actually don't know that, since in Hong Kong they speak Cantonese. On sexual misconduct news, Les Moonves is going to court. Apparently he's not going to work. Eliza Dushku took no bull and made CBS pay up big time, while Sybil Shepherd took a hit for women everywhere back in the day. On Inside Baseball, we've got a new report on Peak TV, and Michael predicts one of advertising's most valued demos will soon become yesterday's news. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, especially music news. Yes, there is a lot of music items in this week's Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you, the listeners, and the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row, including the week we were off, Aquaman. Big, big box office hit in China. This weekend, it made $126 million worldwide. It's in 43 territories. It still hasn't opened up in North America, but it's at $260 million and counting after a really big opening in China last weekend. So that movie is off to a great start. Also off to a great start is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, another animated film from Sony. Their animation division has really had a lot of good, solid success, and this one may be one of their best yet. Great reviews for this movie. Really cool look. I saw it and enjoyed it. It made $56 million on its opening weekend. At number three, another animated flick, it's Dr. Seuss's The Grinch. This has made $35 million over the weekend and $375 million worldwide. Most of the attention we gave was to Ralph Breaks the Internet, because that got great reviews. But Dr. Seuss's The Grinch is outpacing it right now, and it has a couple big weeks left before Christmas makes the movie old news. So we'll have to see where they end up. Dr. Seuss opened quicker. Ralph Breaks the Internet still has more territories to go. But right now, Dr. Seuss is at $375 million worldwide. Ralph Breaks the Internet is at $285 million worldwide, and that cost a lot more money. So Ralph needs to get to $600 million just to break even, whereas Dr. Seuss, Universal, making it on a dime for $75 million, that movie's already in the black. It's made five times its budget.
Well, and at CineAsia, Disney does their presentation. All the studios do their presentation about movies coming up over the next year. And a lot of it is, for Disney, it's like, hey, you're just going to play these movies because they're all going to make a mint. It's mm-hmm. Marvel and Lucasfilm and, all the big movies. Right afterwards, they were going to show Ralph Breaks the Internet. And literally, the place was packed, probably 300-400 people. And then, the product presentation and the actual screening of the movie, everybody got up and left. And I said, if you weren't making $7 billion, I'd feel sorry for you. And mm-hmm. oh, by the way, this movie came out 2 weeks ago. So
right, yeah, they've already seen it. Yeah. That's all. At number four around the world is Bohemian Rhapsody, still doing great and getting some award attention. $25 million on the weekend, $635 million worldwide. That blows my mind in every possible way. Those are a lot of big hits right there. But right there at number five is our first flop. It's Mortal Engines, a film overseen by the people behind Lord of the Rings, including Peter Jackson. This one has been a big flop in 55 territories. It opened up this weekend and made $19 million. Since Wednesday or maybe last weekend and wherever else it opened up, it's at $42 million worldwide. Terrible reviews, terrible opening here in North America. It would have to have its bacon saved by China to get anywhere near its budget, which is anywhere from $100 to $150 million worldwide. So to triple that is going to be a really hard road to hoe. Below that is Ralph Breaks the Internet, which we also mentioned. And at number seven around the world is the new Clint Eastwood film, The Mule. Cranky older people everywhere showed up at the box office. It made $17 million on its opening weekend. Decent reviews, an older audience. That means they're not rushing to the box office right away. So this one should have pretty good legs throughout the holidays. And number eight is Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. Now they have tripled their budget. We think it cost about $200 million to make, and now it has made $600 million worldwide. And number nine, another animated film. This one is a classic, My Neighbor Totoro. It's 30th anniversary from Studio Ghibli and, of course, Hayao Miyazaki. It's finally being released in China, and it made $13 million on the weekend. It opened up, I guess, on Wednesday or Thursday. It's at $14 million total. Great opening weekend in China. Guess what? When this film came out originally, it made a total of $6 million worldwide. $6 million. It's almost tripled that in one weekend in China. But it was a big, big hit. Don't get me wrong. Because on home video, that movie made $260 million worldwide. That is a movie people really discovered on DVD and video cassette. And in merchandise, it made $1.1 billion worldwide and counting. Totoro is like Winnie the Pooh in Japan. So that is a big character, a big franchise. It's only the one movie. But boy, after all these years, it came out in China and people were still lining up to see it.
Well, and it only came out in China. And I can tell you, it was big, big news over there. Totoro. They kept saying, you know, why is it being released now? Well, you know, it's being released now. It was pirated extensively. For 30 years, and yet it still
undoubtedly
manages to make, you know, what was it,
a nice little bit of change.
13 million, yeah,
14, yeah,
14 total, yeah.
In Japan, Dragon Ball Z Super Broly came out. This is the 20th in the Dragon Ball Z anime franchise. It made $8 million on its weekend. These are modest films made on a dime. We don't know the budget, but it'll probably be okay. They've made 20 of them. At number 11 around the world is Creed 2, the boxing flick. Another $7 million on the weekend. That's at $130 million worldwide. So they're going to triple their budget of $50 million. That looks all solid and steady. And number 12, another flop. This is The Nutcracker and the Four Realms. Not everything Disney does is perfect. That's at $160 million worldwide. And it's played poorly, I think, in every territory where it's appeared. And number 13 is the Mark Wahlberg family flick, Instant Family. $68 million and counting worldwide. And number 14, South Korea has that drama set during negotiations with the International Monetary Fund. There's a film that'll get the kids flocking to the theaters. It's called Default, and it's made $25 million and counting. Another flop. Don't mean to emphasize this, but there they are. Robin Hood with Taron Egerton, who's very much looking forward to the next Kingsman movie. This one made $75 million worldwide. And then here's an interesting story. It's Once Upon a Deadpool. This is the re-edited version of Deadpool with a new framing device. They shot it in one day on one set and then re-edited it. Who knows what they spent to make it? Not a lot, but surely it must have cost $1 million at least, right? To get everybody, shoot it for a day, new script, editing, you know, some digital advertising, stuff like that, right? Whatever happened, the movie came out. It did a lot better than I thought. It has made $3.8 million since Wednesday. That's when it first came out here in North America. I didn't think it would make $1 million over the 5 days. So I feel like I'm wrong. I feel like I was proven wrong that there was a very modest audience. But if this was going to work, when they make the next Deadpool movie, if they have a PG-13 version available in theaters at the same time, I think that would be the best measure to see if there's actually an audience that wants to see Deadpool but can't take their kids to an R-rated movie.
Well, and or don't want to, you know.
Right, don't, yeah, can't is in a morally object, exactly. But, you know, I'm sure they didn't spend a lot of money to get it out there. We're assuming it doesn't cost much to make a digital print anymore. They're probably out of that by now, right? Do people still pay the you know, physical print fees?
You know, the virtual print fee? Yeah. Less and less and less and less.
So that may not have been an issue. So the cost of making this new version and shipping it out to 1,000 screens was not a lot of money, was it?
Probably not at all, no. I mean, that said, I will tell you that I found out how much Amazon paid to market, not make or acquire, to market Beautiful Boy.
Well, that had an elaborate campaign.
$25 million. I was like, why would you spend that? Why would you spend that much money?
Because they wanted an Oscar hopeful. They're hoping to get a Best Supporting Actor nomination. I mean, that's what a lot of movies would cost to promote, isn't it?
Yes. But that movie... a movie about basically a father, son, drug, you know, no, don't spend $25 million marketing that movie.
I'm sure that includes the TV ad, the ad campaign for the Oscars too. I'm sure it's not just, you know, TV ads.
Well, it was $25 million that I was told had already been spent. And I was just like, wow, okay.
Well, you know, when they're advertising Once Upon a Deadpool, they probably didn't have a lot of TV ads. They probably just had digital and YouTube and especially Facebook. That's where more and more money is going to. The vast majority of advertising for movies still goes to TV. That's still a big driver, but they are getting a pretty good bang for their buck on digital advertising. So I'm sure that's where that movie had itself played out in terms of trying to reach an audience and letting them know, hey, we exist. At number 17 around the world is The Possession of Hannah Grace, an inexpensive horror flick that's tripled its budget. It's at $30 million worldwide. Steve McQueen's Widows is still pulling in a little bit of money. It's at $70 million worldwide. Bit of a disappointment for a movie that cost $42 million to make. And finally, at number 19 is A Star is Born, $2.9 million on the weekend, $375 million worldwide, and it's about $800,000 away from hitting the $200 million mark in North America. It's going to get there. It's got all the awards attention going for it. So that is a big, big hit. But if you have a film that you know has been playing worldwide and it made $3 million this weekend and it's not on our list, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And of course, I have to say, in talking to all of the Indian exhibitors over the past week, there are a lot of films we're not hearing about.
I'm sure, yeah. So if they don't bother and they don't care about letting us know about it or letting ComScore know, they don't get the name recognition. So I think it's a mistake. They really should offer up that info and get it out there.
Well, I mean, think about it this way. Very often in India, there aren't studios behind these films. And a producer is just that. It's a guy... a woman who's made a movie, maybe they've mortgaged their house to make this movie, they'll release one movie.
I'm sure most are veterans, you know.
Well, yeah, most, but there are a lot of producers that will release one movie every 2, maybe 3 years, and, you know, that's how, you know, the movies are released there, and it's the producer that sets the ticket price, not the movie theater chain.
Well, you know, when they're trying to raise money for the next movie, it would help to show, hey, look at all the attention we got worldwide. So I think it's, again, not to their advantage to keep that secret. I mean, everybody in India knows what the big hits are, but spread the word, especially when you see more and more films charting in China. You can say, hey, look, there's some money to be made. So let them know when you got a big hit in India, because that means when you head to China or the United States or elsewhere, it's got a bigger name recognition on, you know, right off the bat.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
Yeah, we don't know what Roma has made at the box office. It's still in theaters, and people are still going, but we have no idea because, of course, Netflix is not reporting how much money it's making. However, we believe it's played on 40 screens in North America. And to put that in perspective, that's fewer than it played on in Poland or South Korea.
You know, when I was in in, I'm trying to remember the exact neighborhood in Hong Kong. It wasn't in the Kowloon area. Mm-hmm. But at the Broadway Cinematheque, there was a giant poster advertising it, and they were showing Roma on three screens.
There you go. A Cinepolis in Mexico, they refused to distribute the film because of the issues with Netflix. They really wanted them to carry the movie, but the negotiations fell apart. They got close for a while. So is Netflix doing enough to help it? I don't know. But the box office, no matter what Roma contributes to that, they're doing pretty well, aren't they?
Yeah. In terms of awards,
the whole
certainly.
Box office, the whole box office.
Wait, I'm sorry.
No, I'm talking about the year in movies. We don't know what Roma's made. I'm saying the box office
okay.
in general is doing great.
I'm sorry. I was trying to figure out the name of the Hong Kong. Yeah, okay. In any case, yeah, you're right. Okay, we're past $11 billion, so that's kind of nice.
That's at the North American box office, and they did it faster than ever. They made $11 billion quicker than any other year in history.
And we still have 2 weeks to go and some mighty big films to open. So,
and they're mighty big weeks, aren't they?
Yeah, well, certainly, look, the Christmas week alone is one of the biggest weeks of the year, so.
Oh, it's the single biggest week of the year because you got, 7 days in a row where people are going to the box office nonstop.
Well, they're going to the movies. The box office just happens to be in their way.
And Disney is enjoying it, right? They've made $7 billion worldwide alone, and they've still got 3 weeks to go, so they are turning it up as well. Maybe Nutcracker and the Four Realms didn't do great, but they've got other big movies.
That's true. And by the way, speaking of Hong Kong, while I was there, ran into a couple of listeners, including Sam Catalano, who pointed out, by the way, that we keep missing episodes. And I had to apologize for that. So
you mean you taking off?
Yeah.
You mean when you take off? Yes, yeah. It's all your fault.
It is pretty much all my fault. Yes.
Oh, speaking of Disney, they do have Mary Poppins Returns coming. And oddly, it's playing Landmark Theater, which I thought was an odd choice for them. I'm not quite sure why they got that movie in that theater, but it is playing at the Landmark 57 here in Manhattan, along with other big places. Of course, it's going to have a wide, wide opening, but that caught me up a little bit, and Landmark, of course, is in the news.
Well, of course, Landmark has been for sale a couple of times, once in 2011, and then earlier this year it was put on the block by Todd Wagner. Todd Wagner, Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban being the billionaire who's on, what is the name of that show? The reality show where they,
Yep. They pitch products anyway.
They pitch companies and then
we don't care.
But anyway, they sold the company for an undisclosed amount, although most people have it in at $75 million. They sold it to Charles Cohen, who is he's a billionaire real estate magnate. He runs Cohen Media.
He loves movies.
Yeah. He runs.
And he loves movies.
Yeah. I like this guy. He runs Cohen Media Group, okay, so they're a distributor of independent films, but they also refurbish and restore older films, and they have...
Classic, like Criterion, yeah.
Yeah, and then they distribute them. He owns The Quad in New York City, kind of an independent art house, and now he owns Landmark. So I think it's actually a good buy, as I stated in my piece on Celluloid Junkie about it. They have 56 different locations in 27 markets. I can't remember how many screens. I think it's in the 200 range. I know that Netflix kind of was thinking about picking up Landmark. Amazon was thinking about it. Netflix lowballed them. So that's why they were out of the running very early on.
They didn't really want it, I guess. Do they own the land?
There's the question. I think in most cases, probably not.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's a little harder. But there you go. It's kind of like Jeff Bezos buying Washington Post. It's sort of the only people opening up independent art house theater chains are, billionaires with a passionate hobby.
Well, yeah, I guess maybe.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he's making money on it. Certainly Luc Besson is not. His company is on the ropes. We've mentioned it before. They're selling off their pieces to survive. They're still reeling from that flop film Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets. They've gone from 100 employees to 20 in the past 7 years. They're selling off their film library of 500 titles. To me, that is the direst sign of all. If you're selling off your film library, you're done. And they've gone from 10 movies a year down to just 2 when they're lucky. Both films in 2019 that they planned have been pushed back. They're shutting down their in-house distribution business. And Luc Besson is facing police investigation over a formal accusation of rape. So bad, bad times for Luc Besson.
Yeah, wow. I mean, wow. Just talk about a bad year.
Yeah. Well, it's a good year for Roma. You know, we don't know what it's making at the box office, but we know it's getting a lot of love from critics. A lot of critic awards have come out since last week. I will lead us right up to the Zag nominations where you can weigh in on them. But the LA Film Critics came out. They loved Roma. They named it the best film of the year. And the other big surprise was Best Director. That went to Deborah Granik for Leave No Trace, that film starring Ben Foster about a dad and his daughter hiding out in the forest. So those were the big winners at the LA Film Critics. The Golden Globe nominations came out. A lot of movies were nominated. Some movies weren't, of course, as always happens. They did not nominate Roma for Best Picture because it's not eligible. You have to be in an English language to be up for their top award, but they did name it one of the best foreign films of the year. The movie that got a big boost from the Grammys, from the Golden Globes, is Vice. That film got 6 nominations, so they showed a lot of love to Vice.
I wonder if that movie's just coming out too late.
Nah, we got weeks to go. We'll see. We'll see how it piles up and how it does. The Critics' Choice, that's a group of critics. They named their favorite films of the years. No big surprises there. Of course, they had Roma there in the mix, along with Vice and The Favorite and some others. But the awards that matter are the SAG nominations. Why? Because they're picked on by a guild, people who may actually vote in the Oscars. So it's the first indication of some people who might vote for the Oscars and what they actually liked. The Golden Globes, the LA Times, the New York Times, the Critics' Choice, nobody cares. That doesn't matter. So the first award nominations that actually tells us something that might happen are the SAG Awards and what happened there.
Well, first, before I tell you what happened there, what I will say with the LA Film Critics and the Golden Globes and all these Critics' Choice nominations is that it creates this buzz where Academy members say, oh, I should probably see that. It's getting a lot of heat. So, yes, I agree with you. None of those people are Academy voters. None of the people in any of the the Critics' categories or the Golden Globes are going to vote for the Academy Awards or the Oscars. So in a way, it doesn't matter. If anything, it's just marketing campaigns for the Oscars.
It's a helpful little bit of publicity, but it's not heat in terms of momentum because none of them actually vote on the Oscars. And the SAG Awards do.
Correct.
And guess what wasn't nominated for Best Film? Roma. Why? No actors.
Yeah,
the non-pro cast.
Yeah, and that's where, okay, so you're absolutely correct. The largest voting block in the Academy is actors. Okay, that group is actors, and they vote on Best Picture, okay? You're absolutely correct in saying that there are no professional actors in that film. So, of course, when it came to the Screen Actors Guild nominations, they didn't get any because
They were not excited to support the film. They also didn't support First Man or If Beale Street Could Talk. They did give a lot of love to A Star Is Born and to Black Klansman, which also got a Best Actor nomination for Denzel's son, John David Washington, a well-deserved nomination, I think. But Roma, this doesn't mean Roma's not going to get nominated for an Academy Award. It probably will. We feel like it's got a lot of momentum and it's going to get that nomination, though the Netflix thing might stop it there. But will it win Best Picture? Let's just keep in mind the actors were not wildly enthusiastic about it. That doesn't mean it can't win, but it certainly makes it harder.
It could definitely get nominated for Best Picture and maybe, depending on what it's up against,
We could win Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Cinematography.
Right.
They'll give it something. But my pick right now for Best Picture winner, A Star Is Born. Why? Because it'll be the most annoying to me.
So you're like kind of going with the, you know, who's going to be the next president, whoever you want to have a beer with.
Yeah. No, I the Oscars will always frustrate me, will always annoy me and do the thing that is most tiresome. And I think, you know, The Favorite would be less tiresome. Black Panther would be less tiresome, even though it's not one of my favorite films of the year. There are a lot of movies I can make an argument for and go, it's all right. But if they want to annoy me, if they want to annoy Michael, they'll make it A Star Is Born. That will just be such a bland, dull choice. But I think it's right up Oscar's alley. Everybody's loved it. Not me, but SAG loved it. We'll have to see how the other guilds do, assuming Bradley Cooper and all the actors are in their big time, and they have been for SAG and for a lot of other awards nominations. So I think they've got all the momentum in the world. It's a classic Hollywood tale. It's an actor turned director. You know, it's the obvious thing sitting right. Who's going to win? There's your obvious pick. Black Panther, not so obvious. You know, it's a comic book movie. If it gets a nomination, that'll be great. But look, the SAG liked it. Their best films of the year, they went populist, baby. Black Klansman, smart choice. Black Panther, Bohemian Rhapsody, Crazy Rich Asians, and A Star is Born. I mean, Crazy Rich Asians and Bohemian Rhapsody, those are not good movies, but they were popular and SAG loved them.
Well, you don't think it would be more annoying to you if driving Miss Mahershala or Mr. Mahershala would win? And that's the Green Book movie with
Green Book. I think that'll be lucky to win and be a contender for best actor, to be lucky to be nominated, and it'll be a contender for best actor. So I just don't see it as a real threat. I also don't see Kevin Hart as a threat because he was named as the Oscar host and 2 minutes later, never mind.
Yeah, certainly this was, you know, one of those weeks where, or 2 weeks ago was one of those weeks where I was kind of bummed. I was like, oh man, you know, they picked the Oscar host right after we finished recording. We can't include it. I guess we'll just have to include it next week. And guess what? We can include it next week because he dropped out a day later.
And who's the name of the head of the Oscars?
John Bailey.
John Bailey. Yes, he's had a bad year.
Oh,
you know,
my God,
you want to pretend he's done a good job. This guy's done an awful job. And so, you know, this is. I mean, what are we going to pay attention to? They do important work all year long, but what we're paying attention to, of course, are the Oscars. They screwed up on a new category adding. They're going to really have it fly in their face when they try and take some awards off the television broadcast. And now they screwed up on the Oscar host. Everybody knew Kevin Hart had this history of anti-gay comments. And Kevin Hart was not pulled from the Academy Awards hosting gig because of some tweets he made 8 years ago. He's pulled from the gig because for the past 8 years, he's never tried to make amends for those hateful comments. And you know what? Using a gay slur like Sarah Silverman and some other people have done in the past is not remotely the same as saying, I'm going to beat the crap out of my son if I'm worried that he's gay. That's a horrific comment to make. He made that joke multiple times on tweets, in his stand-up act. And ever since then, the most he's ever said is, well, yeah, I wouldn't make that joke today. You know, look at Tracy Morgan, an actor who I do not think is funny, but Tracy Morgan had some homophobic jokes in his stand-up act. And then people called him on and said, gee, I don't know if that's good anymore. And Tracy Morgan came out publicly and said, you know what? That's homophobia, and homophobia is a disease. Then he worked with some gay rights groups to do anti-bullying PSAs, to do some public work and say, hey, look, I'm trying to make amends. Now, maybe he doesn't give a damn about gay people any more than he did back then, but at least he went through the motions and said, yeah, I messed up, and I'm trying to show I'm a new person. But Kevin Hart, he never did that. In fact, he has done other stuff since then that are sort of offensively anti-gay.
Yeah, and he didn't help himself he just kind of kept hurting himself more and more with all of his
public comments. No, I don't mean his last day. I don't mean the day the stuff came up. I'm talking about the last 8 years. It's not because of tweets 8 years ago. It's because he never made amends and he never cared about it. He never showed he'd learned his lesson or felt like he had a lesson to learn. That's why he's not the Oscar host. Not because he showed a video at 2 a.m. saying, leave me alone and be positive. And it's not because of a dumb tweet he did 8 years ago, because people can do dumb tweets.
Here's my question. Have they gotten a host yet?
No. No. I don't know why James Corden isn't. Just let him do it, for Christ's sake. I mean, what's the big deal?
Or like,
decided last week, for God's sake. You're running out of time. They're talking about maybe not having a host. That never works. They've tried that in years past where they just sort of have an amorphous, you know, welcome to the Oscars.
Well, wait a second. You know who they should get?
Available?
Hugh Jackman.
Well, yeah, of course, that's an obvious one, but he's got movies and stuff and he's doing his world tour. He doesn't have time to prepare for the Oscars. He's got a world tour he's doing.
Ellen DeGeneres, you know, she can do.
She's done it before. She doesn't want to do it last minute. You know, when you're picking someone last minute, it's really not easy. You may be someone who's done it before is the wisest and safest choice. But, you know, they want to spend months prepping for it and doing a good job. So they've really boxed themselves in a corner.
I thought what Saturday Night Live had to say about it was like, you know, that has no upside whatsoever. Who wants the job that has no upside whatsoever?
Well, I don't know. Bob Hope and Johnny Carson, it gave them Billy Crystal, made him a hot property for years, kept him cool long after his cool factor was gone. True. So, no, there's a lot to be done with the Oscars. Hugh Jackman's done great with the Tonys. James Corden did well. You know, LL Cool J has done great with the Grammys. You know, no, it's a great gig. No doubt about it. But, you know, they always talk about how many people watch the Oscars, how many people watch the movies in the Middle Kingdom. I wish I had been able to figure this out. How many movie screens does China have right now?
You know, we were all trying to figure that out. Middle Kingdom, by the way, is not from Lord of the Rings. Okay. Let's
just no, it's not right now.
It's, we're talking about China here, and it's somewhere around 45,000 screens.
Really? That's it?
Yeah, it might be close to 50 now. They're, but remember, they're kind of slowing down a bit. Everybody thinks, oh, they're going to have 80,000 screens by 2020.
That's what they just announced.
Right. Well, but you know, what they announce and what happens.
Well, yeah, but totally why are they different. Announcing that? We thought like they hit a wall and they had too many screens and they were building them in areas where they didn't need them. And they were just building movie screens to get tax breaks, just like they had an explosion of too many local tiny crappy theme parks. If they were overbuilding and building in areas where they didn't need movie screens yet or maybe never, we felt like, okay, they've hit a wall. Well, they're going to slow down and get a little more reason.
The government might be building some of these or at least kind of subsidizing some of these because you know what? You know,
well, we know they are. They're giving tax breaks. They're encouraging building of movie screens, even when it's not necessary.
Look, the people going to the movies don't have time to revolt. Okay. So that's one of the reasons they're doing that.
It is a big market. It's number two market in the world, but the U.S. is growing just as much. I should say North America. So they're not gaining any ground really this year. Maybe they will start to do that again next year, but it's still a very, very big market, which is why Marvel has greenlit its first Asian superhero movie. The news was shared on Weibo. Was it Weibo or Weibo? I always
Weibo.
Forget. Weibo, thank you. More than 170 million times in less than 2 days. The character is Shang-Chi. It's a 1970s superhero from Marvel Comics, inspired by the meteoric success of Bruce Lee. He's the son, apparently, of Fu Manchu, and he trained all his life in martial arts until his skill is almost supernatural. That's how good he is. Then he discovers his dad has evil tendencies, and he rebels to do good. Clearly, Marvel wants to make like Black Panther and cast an Asian cast, get an Asian director, at least an Asian American director. They're looking at David Callahan. He's scripting to do that after doing Wonder Woman 1984 and working on the Spider-Verse 2 sequel. So he's a hot talent in terms of superhero comic book movies. And some Asian audiences are not happy about the Fu Manchu link because that's, of course, a yellow peril stereotype of the old days, the evil Asian guy. But I'm sure they could tweak it and make it in a way that, you know, he could be misunderstood or maybe it's not Fu Manchu at all. You know, they're not going to be hamstrung by what was done in a comic book in the 70s.
Well, I know, Michael, you know, part of the increase in ticket sales over the past year here in North America has been due to all these people racing to the movies with their movie pass and driving box office up by what I think some people said $500 million. That is not true. It's not $500 million. I would say it's probably, well, I don't know what it is, but it's not $500 million. I would say I have MoviePass. You've got Cinemia. We've talked before the show began about your struggles with Cinemia. We're not going to get into that here. But MoviePass, speaking of struggles, they have this new pricing structure, and I have to say it's more confusing than the last one. I have no idea how to even describe this or explain it.
Well, every week they try something new. A week ago, they sent out an email saying, hey, would you be willing to just get discount on tickets for like $5 a month? And then we'll give you like $3 or $4 off a ticket. Would that be cool? This week, they've announced a big new subscription plan. All right. It's going to be multiple levels of choice and multiple levels depending on where you live. So if you live in the heartland and you want to see 3 movies a month and you don't care when you go, you're happy to go during the week. All right, that's level one. If you want to be able to go whenever you want, well, that's going to be the most expensive level. And if you live in Manhattan, you're going to pay more than if you live in Oklahoma. So they're recognizing, hey, geography matters, which is smart. They maybe should have done that from the get-go. But when you're competing with AMC and Cinemia and more flexibility and more movies to try to get people to sign up for 3 movies a month from a company that used to give you 1 movie a day, that's really hard. Even worse, it looks like they want an annual subscription. They want you to pay right from the get-go, and they're not accepting credit card info. It looks like they want a debit directly from your bank account. I'm like, huh?
I would not let these people debit from my bank account.
Yeah, and they're a penny stock now. Helios, the owner of MoviePass, is a penny stock. They've been delisted on NASDAQ, and they're under investigation for fraud. So I don't know anyone who's still on their monthly plan. The only people I know still using MoviePass are those who have an annual subscription, and they're waiting for it to phase out. Anybody signing up an extra $240 or $360 to sign up for MoviePass for another year, not going to happen.
Yeah, I happen to be one of those people, by the way.
Waiting for it to fade out. Yeah. And you're afraid to cancel it because you want to get as much use out of it as you can, but you want to make sure they don't try and re-up you for another year, right?
Oh, I'm definitely not getting re-upped for another year. No doubt.
Well, but they'll automatically do it unless you cancel. You know, you've got to find that final month where you can cancel and make sure they don't charge you for the new one, but still let you use the pass for the last few weeks.
January is my month.
There you go. Well, this is not a good month for Woody Allen, Les Moonves, or, well, it is a good month for Elijah Dushku, which brings us to sexual misconduct news. Right now, the Hollywood Reporter just came out with a new story talking to about a woman who, when she was 16 years old, started to date Woody Allen. She had an affair with him for 8 years, she said. It's well documented. And of course, when they started to have a relationship, that would have been statutory rape in New York State. So and she says their relationship sort of she saw mirrored in the film Manhattan. And of course, 8 years, that takes her into the late 80s, which means she was 24, 25 by the end of their relationship, and that's when he started to date Sunyi Previn. Tacky. Les Moonves is headed to court. CBS had an internal investigation that shows Les Moonves lied to investigators repeatedly. There was a female employee who apparently regularly performed oral sex in his office, which he insists was consensual, though I don't know how appropriate it is. Should you be doing that at work? And all of his behavior, others knew, and they knew about this woman and considered her untouchable. You couldn't fire her or discipline her. The abuse and harassment was far more extensive than previously reported, and senior execs and board members had knowledge of his misconduct. We're talking about a $120 million severance package at stake here. So people are going to sue, and you know what? It's going to be embarrassing, but he's going to go to court and say, hey, you guys knew what I was doing. You had no problem for years. So
I was making you billions of dollars is what I was doing.
Yeah, you can't pretend now suddenly you care because you don't want to give me my $120 million. Screw you. You knew. You knew it for years. So don't pretend that that's why you fired me. It's going to get ugly, isn't it?
I think it's, it's going to get very ugly and it'll probably go on for at least 2 years.
And Sybil Shepherd spoke up. And she said, you know what? She had her hit show, Sybil, in the 90s. It was a little up and down. It wasn't a massive hit, but it was a hit. And in its fourth season, she says Les Moonves suddenly hit on her and propositioned her. She turned him down, and then boom, her sitcom was canceled. It was canceled rather abruptly to the point where it was a season-ender cliffhanger, which was not as unusual in those days. But people did scratch their heads a little bit and think maybe there was another season in it, especially because back then you still wanted to get to 100 episodes. So one more year would have made a lot of sense for everyone involved. So it was a head scratcher, and Sybil is saying, you know what, this is why.
Well, it makes sense, I guess, whether, you know, I'll take her word for it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, there's no, of course you'll take her word for it. Why the hell would she lie?
Yeah.
And you know what? CBS, bad culture at 60 Minutes. A lot of stories about the bad culture there. And on other shows, going up right up to today, Eliza Dushku, terrific actress. I loved her on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She came out during the Me Too moment and said, when she was just a child, she was like 9 years old, and she was sexually abused by a stunt coordinator on the set of True Lies. So very, very great of her to share that painful, embarrassing, awful story. And it's not now. It shows her being strong and being willing to talk about this so that other people can hopefully get protection. And then other people came forward talking about this guy. So great for her. But you know what? That story is in the past. And you would hope all the bad news is in the past. Uh-uh. Turns out CBS paid Eliza Dushku $9.5 million for her being harassed on the set of Bull, the new TV show they have. It's a hit show. It stars Michael Weatherly, and she was booked on the show for a long arc as a new love interest for him. He took that a little too seriously and made numerous repeated demeaning and vulgar comments to her on the set in front of lots of crew members, to the point where she said, I don't want to be here anymore. And CBS let her leave the show and also paid her because she was being screwed out of all the work and money she had booked. She'd booked a long arc on the show. So she complained about being uncomfortable, and his comments were so public and so obviously wrong, they dished out the money. And what did they do to Michael Weatherly? As far as we know, nothing.
Well, he's still on the show.
Of course, they've got a hit show. Is the lead guy going to pay a price when you got a hit show and the lead actor is the guy making it happen? Uh-uh. And that's a hard, difficult problem for people to deal with. CBS obviously has a terrible culture. That's going to be the reputation for a long time to come, thanks to Les Moonves, and as more and more stories come forward. You know, bad person on NCIS, they don't care. They got hit shows. They don't care what a producer does. They don't care what a director does. They don't care what a cinematographer does. They don't even care what the lead actor does, not when they're making you money. And that's probably not going to change for a long, long time. It's really hard to make something like that end.
Well, I wonder if some of our listeners will care about the stories we have in Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Tell me what you want, Michael, what you really, really want. Well, when it came to Grammy nominations, what they really wanted were more women, and boy, did they get them. The big four categories, album, song, record, and best new artist, were all dominated by women. As a bonus, rap music got its due, though that left pop and rock music out in the cold. Major categories expanded to 8, and when it came to album of the year, 5 of them were women, and none of them were Taylor Swift or Ariana Grande. Along with the soundtrack to Black Panther and hip-hop albums by Drake and Post Malone, the album nominees included Cardi B, H.E.R. or Her, Janelle Monáe, Kacey Musgraves, and Michael's early pick for Best Album of the Year, Brandi Carlile's By the Way, I Forgive You. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. They got what they wanted. They switched up the nomination process. They wanted to get more diversity, more women, and it paid off. Whether it's a great list of the best albums of the year, I don't know. My favorite album so far is Janelle Monáe. I'm not saying Brandi Carlile is going to win, but it is one of my favorite albums of the year. I don't think she'll pull it out. Who's going to win? I don't know, but it'll be fun to see. 6 of the 8 best new artists are women. That's fascinating. But a lot of rock and pop and things missed out. Panic at the Disco, Arctic Monkeys, Ariana Grande and Taylor Swift. And
well, Taylor Swift, I mean, come on, she's dead, right? I mean, she can't even come to the phone.
I mean, she really had a, you know, even though her album was disappointing relative to older albums, it's still one of the big albums of the year and one of the big tours. So, you know, she can't win and be nominated every year. But don't think they've learned their lesson too much, because if you look at all the other categories, you can still a lot of old school idiocy is on play by the Grammys. But they did a better job in the big categories where it counts.
Speaking of old school, the National Film Registry has added a clutch of Hollywood films, indies, shorts, documentaries, and fragments of film to the Library of Congress. Remember, these aren't necessarily great films. They're just as often included for their pop cultural or historical importance. Hence the perfectly reasonable inclusion of junk like Jurassic Park and My Fair Lady. Hey, wait a second, My Fair Lady. Alongside genuinely good films like Brokeback Mountain, Eve's Bayou, and Monterey Pop. Among the more obscure items on the list of 25 works honored and preserved, a 29-second fragment from 1898 of the first on-screen kiss among people of color, and footage of Crow Native Americans filmed by an expedition fitted out and backed by Wanamaker's department store. It was actually backed by the founder of Wanamaker, or the guy who ran it. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, really? Is that true? Because I thought it was for promotional purposes at the department store.
So did I, until I looked it up, and it was just him, you know, him, Roland Wanamaker, kind of saying, yeah, I want to go out there and you know, document this way of life, which is disappearing.
They didn't do anything with it at the department store or anything like that?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes more sense. I was utterly puzzled by it. Like, Wanamakers? I thought that was completely bizarre. So yeah, some significant films like On the Town, which was one of the early films shot on location in New York, The Shining, the documentary Hearts and Minds, Broadcast News. I love that film. I really don't get Jurassic Park, though. I don't know that the special effects are that noteworthy. Maybe they are. Maybe there was some breakthrough there.
There was. It was one of the first uses of computer-generated imaging that was realistic, where you couldn't really tell the difference between what, you know, the dinosaurs that were practical and the CGI dinosaurs. It was, you know, that was the first use of that.
They had practical dinosaurs?
Well, you know, like the foot or the head.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as 3D or color or some other innovation, CGI. Okay. But I don't know. I guess if that's the reasoning, that makes sense. Otherwise, I really don't get it as significant in any way other than perhaps that technical breakthrough.
Hey, what's the best way to become president? You could be governor of New York or host a TV show. Well, the Cuomo family is trying both ways. Andrew Cuomo is the Democratic governor of New York, and Michael, by the way, is not a fan.
Not a fan, not a fan.
But hey, let's get to it. Chris Cuomo is hosting his own show on CNN at 9 p.m., the old time slot of Larry King, and he's doing great. CNN reports that Cuomo has built a solid audience very quickly and in the toughest time slot for cable news. He airs opposite Sean Hannity on Fox News and Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. Both of those other shows grab right around 3 million viewers, and with Hannity having a slight edge in the 25 to 54 demo, Cuomo is way behind at 1.2 million viewers and 381,000 viewers in the key demo. But that's up sharply in just 6 months, bigger than his lead-in, Anderson Cooper, and giving a boost to his lead-out, Don Lemon.
Of course, Don Lemon, call me. Anyway.
Of course, sorry. Cuomo isn't running for president, at least not yet. So is this a big deal or a big whoop? And I guess my question is, which Cuomo isn't running for president?
Yeah, hopefully we're talking about Mario. I mean, Chris, Mario. Yeah, Mario would be nice too. Yeah, and I think it's a big deal. It's a big step forward for CNN, but you can see they have a long way to go. But they play a much bigger role in online and other ways of getting out their news information. So their primetime ratings are just the tip of the iceberg in front of the impact of CNN. Fox News and MSNBC are way behind in those terms. But it's good news for them, and that's always good for them to have. And I like Don Lemon and Anderson Cooper, so that's a good solid prime time. And in other TV news, Kathy Lee, this is even bigger news. She's leaving the Today Show, the fourth hour. She's been on there for a decade. I can't believe how quickly time goes by. Dear God. She's been on there for a decade. It seems like yesterday she was on, you know, Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. But nope, she's been there for 10 years. She's going to leave in April on their 11th anniversary, something like that. And Hoda Kotb, I thought, oh, maybe she'll get a break and not have to do, you know, three. Nope, she's definitely staying in the fourth hour. So she's doing the first 2 hours of Today and the fourth hour. She gets an hour off, I guess, to prep for her wine drinking. And who's going to be her co-host? Whoever Hoda wants.
I'll do it.
Absolutely. I would do it. Yeah. Although, I would be terrible for that. That would not be for me. I'm a late night guy, not an early morning guy.
Yeah. You literally, they'd be like, yeah, you know, Michael's late again.
And everything they do would be so annoying and stupid. I would not be good. The morning chit chat is not for me.
Yeah.
I could do The View, but I could not do that fourth hour of Today.
Well, could you go on tour with U2 or Coldplay or Ed Sheeran? Because they all made over $100 million. Actually, Bruno Mars made over $100 million.
Yeah, it was a big year. Our friend Zach O'Malley-Greenberg at Forbes put out a list of the top earning musicians of 2018. It's not just from touring, it's from everything. But U2 is at the top of the list, $118 million. And Coldplay, they're sort of a legacy act too at this point, aren't they? They made $115 million. You got Guns N' Roses in there at $71 million. Roger Waters of Pink Floyd, $68 million. But what struck me was how many of these people are pretty young. Ed Sheeran, Bruno Mars, Katy Perry, Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Pink, Lady Gaga, Luke Bryan, Calvin Harris, Drake. All these people are on the list, and these people are making big bucks. These are the legacy acts of the future. These are the U2s and Rolling Stones and Bruce Springsteens of the future, and they're doing really well. So that's a nice, fresh list in my mind. In previous years, you'd just see The Who, The Stones, U2. We got a lot of fresh acts that are making big bucks, and they're going to be around for many years to come.
Taylor Swift on Broadway.
She could do it.
Well, none of those big name acts has the slightest interest in playing the Super Bowl halftime show. Maroon 5 got the gig this year, but it's proving more of an albatross than a career peak. First, Rihanna let slip that she had been offered the slot but turned it down because she wanted to honor the right of free speech for Colin Kaepernick, who, by the way, is a former football player whose political protests have kept him sidelined, for those of you not in the U.S. Now, as well, Rihanna generally wanted nothing to do with a sport whose owners are tainted by a plantation mentality, racism, and the fact that players face serious medical issues for the rest of their life after they retire. Ouch. So congrats, Maroon 5. Congrats for, you know, I guess getting that gig. Anyway, few acts in recent years go it alone. They bring on duet partners and special guests and make it a party. Think about it. Janet Jackson brought out, who was that guy? Oh yeah, that's right. Justin Timberlake. That's right. And Coldplay brought out both Beyonce and Bruno Mars. Maroon 5 has reportedly approached a half dozen big name acts, and no one wants to get within a mile of the show. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. And good God, I think Lee Greenwood should book his show next year. You know, they're going to be stuck with him singing God Bless the USA at the 2019 or 2020 Super Bowl. I mean, who are they going to get next year? This has become poisonous.
And well, I mean, really, there are acts who do go it alone. Bruce Springsteen did, Tom Petty did, Prince did.
No, but they're not going to want to do it. I'm not talking about, no one's going to want to even be Maroon 5. I'm not saying they're going to have trouble getting guests. They're going to have trouble booking an act, period.
Oh, yeah, no, that's year. Very, very true.
Right, yeah, no, this is a disaster for the Super Bowl. They're going to have Up With People again. I mean, this is not a good thing.
Hey, Michael, want to go see Paul McCartney, though, in concert?
Of course. Is he playing New York, L.A.? Do you have tickets?
Well, no, none of those things. He's playing in Mexico City, and I've got us a place via Airbnb for the weekend.
Cool.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like we're crazy rich Asians traveling the globe just to go see a concert, but more and more, the industry is noticing that fans will travel to another country to catch a live event. StubHub alone says it saw several hundred thousand people buying tickets to events outside their own country. In fact, it tracked people from 144 countries buying tickets for a show in another country. Legacy acts like Paul McCartney aren't the only ones making this happen. So are acts like K-pop boy band and my new best friends, BTS, with its global audience and even theatrical events like Hamilton. It's easier to travel than ever, perhaps easier than ever to book an apartment or hotel just for a few days. And of course, acts can reach fans all over the world when that fan signs up for their newsletter. If you live in Toronto, you aren't going to see an ad for a show in London, but Ed Sheeran will send you an alert when they go on sale. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I don't know how you feel, but it seems like, wow, I mean, the air travel and money and expenses, it's certainly something a lot of people couldn't even consider. But for those middle, upper class and rich, yeah, you know, it's a growing audience. People who will go to a festival, especially, we can catch, you know, a dozen acts. I'm sure that's an even bigger draw than a single show. So it's an interesting new wrinkle in music going.
Yeah, I mean, festivals have always been international draws. So, you know, whether it's Coachella or Bonnaroo or Glastonbury, that's always been, you know, an event that people flew in for.
Maybe that gets them in the habit. Once you've done that once, then suddenly you go, hey, I want to see Hamilton in London.
Yeah, I don't know about seeing Paul McCartney in Mexico City when you know that Paul McCartney could be coming to, I don't know, you know, Los Angeles or San Francisco or Seattle.
Well, it's I'm sure it's both. One, they're not coming to your city. And two, can you get a great seat? If you can get a great seat in Mexico City, you know, then maybe the tickets aren't the same price. They're not as high a little bit. It wouldn't be discounted in Mexico City. It's a major city. But, you know, if you got a ticket to Toronto, okay, I'll go to Toronto. If you get a ticket in London, maybe I'll go to London. You know, if you're in, you know, Ohio or Chicago and you're going to go to LA or New York just to see a show, why not? If you get the ticket, maybe you don't care where that city is as much. You know, the hard part is getting a good seat.
It's not hard to listen to music. Not anymore, actually, thanks to streaming services. And my question is, Spotify worried? Because Apple reports it's adding 1 million subscribers a month, and it hit 56 million subscribers as of November 2018. That includes people who get a free trial. Meanwhile, Spotify added 2 million subscribers a month over the last 6 months and hit 87 million worldwide. Both companies are slowing down from 1 year ago, but Spotify is slowing down faster. In the last six-month span, they added 8 million in the first 12 weeks and then just 4 million in the last 12 weeks. I know that sounds
so
like...
So they added 12 million people, but at a much slower pace in the last few months. Yeah.
Right. Basically, yeah, exactly. 8 million, yeah. Now, is this a big deal or a big whoop? And or by the way, are you just listening to Neil Young's Pono? That's my question.
Exactly. I'd love to listen to Pono, but I can't buy, you know, $25 albums just to get a good digital file. So I don't think Spotify is worried. It looks like, you know, Apple still has that huge built-in advantage of every time people get a new iPhone. There is Apple right there. They've got their credit card info. It's so easy to sign up for it. That may give them an advantage ultimately, but Spotify's holding its own. And in fact, speaking of Pono, that upscaling of high quality audio, Spotify just opened up a service, I believe in Japan, or no, Sony did. Sony did in Japan of high quality streaming. They feel like there's a market for people who want to hear really good quality audio files. And they've just done that in Japan.
We love lawsuits. We do. But if major corporations had their way, no one could sue anyone. Well, except for them, of course. They would like to sue people. Major corporations love arbitration, and they try to insist that all their employees and all their customers and all their clients must turn to private arbitration rather than lawsuits or, you know, heaven forbid, class action lawsuits. It's not working so well anymore, though. The latest to discover this is CAA, Creative Artists Agency. They fired agent Ben Dagra in their football department, and when he challenged it, they went to arbitration. The problem? They fired him at a meeting, didn't tell him why, and tried to insist he was fired with cause, which would save them a ton of money. Dagra won the arbitration. I mean, he was a jerk, but hey, that didn't seem so unusual to the arbitrator when it came to agents. And since CAA,
I think it's a job requirement.
Yeah, exactly. CAA never told Dagra why he was being fired or gave him a chance to change his ways. They couldn't say he was fired with cause. Dagra was glad to keep the $15 million award, but also wanted to put out a press release saying he'd been fired without cause, you know, kind of clear his name, so to speak. CAA objected and sued in court, but then immediately sealed everything about the deal. Dagra countersued and then immediately unsealed his claims, including the judgment of the arbitrator. Maybe they'll all keep suing each other, but until then, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I mean, I wish someone would sue us, because that would mean we really had made it. You know, if we said something, they sued us and said, how dare you say that? People would know our names. It'd be so exciting. I think it's a big deal. I mean, arbitration clauses are crazy. They've exploded. They're everywhere. It's ridiculous. You're McDonald's cashier and they have you under an arbitration clause. It's got to die. It's got to hopefully be, you know, dealt with in the courts. That's where it's going to happen. But look at the absurdity of this. They fire you. They tell the world they fired you with cause. Then they force you to go to arbitration. They lose, but then they don't want you to be able to tell anyone that you weren't fired with cause. Like, it's like, I can't clear my name. No, it was in secret arbitration. You can't say anything about it. I mean, that's just crazy talk.
Well, you know, first of all, you know, at least in the state of California, you're always fired for cause, because all employment, no matter whether it's under contract or not, in the state of California is at will. So when you're being fired, it's always for cause. Doesn't matter.
Well, but it's not, just, not in terms of your benefits, though, and your compensation.
Exactly. So in other words,
it matters.
Right. Exactly. Which is why you're always fired for cause, even if it's for no cause at all. And that's why there are so many wrongful termination suits in the state of California, because, you know, employers just automatically say, oh, we're firing for cause. Well
they all do that because they want to, it's cheaper for them.
Exactly. And then they only have to fight those who come back at them.
But right. That's true everywhere. Yeah. Right.
Now, Mariah Carey, she is enjoying a new top 10 hit, but not with a song from her new album. Instead, Carey is notching another big smash with her holiday perennial, All I Want for Christmas Is You. You know, All I Want for Christmas is not to hear that song again, by the way.
it's a classic. It's a good song.
It's a number 7 this week, thanks to streaming and the switchover in adult contemporary radio to all holiday songs. Thank you for that, by the way. Don't be surprised to see it climb even higher next week. And hitting the top 40 for the first time is Wham's Last Christmas. The rules change now and then, of course, but if a song gets enough traction in airplay and sales and streaming, it can re-enter the charts again and again. Heck, Bing Crosby's White Christmas topped the charts 3 different years in the 1940s, so why not Mariah? Holiday hits are the reason. You can also find unlikely singers charting this week, including Gene Autry, Dean Martin, Burl Ives, and Andy Williams, enjoying his first hit since 1971. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It's just, you know, a little thing in the charts. But I like it because she's getting airplay, getting a lot of streaming, and people are paying attention to the song. So it deserves to be on the charts. It's being played a lot on the air. You know, this is the problem with like the book charts and so many other things. The New York Times says, we won't list kids' books on the charts anymore because they were annoyed that Harry Potter was dominating the charts. Never mind that was going to fade. But every year come graduation, Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You'll Go would pop up on the New York Times bestseller list for a few weeks because people were buying it as a graduation gift. It was the best-selling book of the week. Now it never appears anymore because they just pretend it doesn't exist. And that's crazy. If All I Want for Christmas Is You is getting the most airplay and enough sales that it makes it on the charts, it should be on there. So yeah, every holiday you're going to see it. What are you going to do? But guess what? White Christmas was so big, the original recording is lost forever. They burned that original master out. and he had to re-record it like 2 or 3 years later, and he tried to do it almost the same, except they added a Celeste and some other stuff. But that original one was so overused, it just was worn down to nothing. 50 million copies they think they sold. Unbelievable. Wow. Yeah, you think you're sick of All I Want for Christmas Is You. White Christmas must have been a nightmare.
Well, you know, it's funny, when you're walking around Hong Kong and you actually see Chinese buskers singing that song. It's very funny.
I saw Clay, Ruben and Clay, the two American Idol finalists on Broadway in a holiday show. Don't ask me why, but they sang 800 songs. They sang everything. Medleys, this and that. But boy, the audience perked up right towards the finale when they sang All I Want for Christmas Is You. That is a holiday standard.
All I want for... Anyway, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame named its latest inductees, and they offered something for everyone. Two female artists in Janet Jackson and Stevie Nicks, some overlooked British acts like Def Leppard and The Cure, obvious winners like Radiohead, cult faves The Zombies, and stone-cold rock and roll Hall of Fame-worthy talent in Roxy Music, and its pioneering Brian Eno. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. We covered them all before, but I'm really excited for Roxy Music and especially Brian Eno. He deserves to be in there as a solo artist, as a producer, as a member of Roxy Music. You know, that's a cool band, and you know, British acts have been way overlooked, so glad to know they're finally righting that wrong.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have
I'm sorry. That was baseball. This is inside baseball.
These are headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. And we explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect our audience. Anyway.
All I know is if the Yankees signed Manny Machado, I am not going to be watching them for the next 5 years.
Manny Machado?
They're in talks with him. Can you imagine that? Morons.
Unbelievable.
Lord. They apparently just want a 6 or 8 year deal rather than a 10 year deal, but it's moronic on every possible level.
Wow. Okay. By the way, for those of you outside the country,
that's actual baseball.
that's actual baseball, and that would be a huge deal, both monetarily and
stupidly.
Well, this week, during Inside Baseball, we're going to talk about television and how much money people are spending on content, the frenzy over the sitcom Friends possibly leaving Netflix, something my kids were just like apoplectic over, by the way.
Were they really?
Yeah, because they hadn't finished it yet, to which I said, wait, you're watching Friends? Don't they talk about sex on that show? What are you doing watching Friends? Give me the remote control. A new report, by the way, from FX on Peak TV and the key audience demo that TV networks might want advertisers to forget about. So first off, let's talk about all this spending on content. I mean, if you are in production, okay, if you're like a gaffer, a grip, a production assistant, a production coordinator, a producer even, you know, a line producer, boy, you are working nonstop right now because Disney and Fox are spending $22 billion making content for their upcoming streaming service. Comcast is...
No. This is their total content spend.
Well, that's true. You're right. Yes, sorry.
No, it's Network ABC, ESPN. No, this is all their content. Right. Yeah, this is not...
I immediately looked to Netflix spending $8 billion, right? So that's kind of where
this is their movies. You know, this is everything.
Yeah, and then you got Amazon spending $5 billion for their service. Comcast and Sky, okay, the non-streaming people, you know, big difference between $5 billion, $8 billion. $21 billion they're spending, Comcast and Sky.
And then Quibo, that's a Jeffrey Katzenberg company. They're going to be spending $600 million they think within 5 years they'll be spending $1 billion. So I thought this was nice. It put into perspective the $8 billion that Netflix spends on content. They got films, they got TV shows, they got a ton of stuff. Right, but Disney, they're paying $22 billion. I mean, that's when you got ABC and ESPN and all these channels and the Disney Channel and streaming services and movies and theaters. That's a lot of money. So, you know, you get wowed by the $8 billion Netflix is spending. Well, guess what? The big boys, they spend a lot more.
Right. And everybody thinks, well, $8 billion, why are they spending so much money? Why are they making so much content? Well, first of all, they have to build up a library. Okay. That's what Netflix and Amazon are doing with at least their television content. Okay, certainly some of their movie content, yes. But their television content, they're building a library. And what is a library worth? you know, I remember when back in the 90s, everybody was shocked, or maybe it was the 2000s, everybody was shocked. My God, all those People and Friends, they're making $1 million an episode. That's $22 million a year. They'll never make their money back in syndication. Well, guess what? My kids in 2018 are watching Friends, and Netflix subscribers, that's where they're watching this. You know, they love their Central Perk. And when the streaming service inadvertently, by the way, included a posting that suggested the sitcom would end its run on Netflix on January 1st, 2019, everybody was up in arms. Turns out that, of course, contracts come up all the time. But not to worry, Friends isn't going anywhere. It's going to stay on Netflix. At least it's not going anywhere yet. Company head Ted Sarandos said the idea Friends would not be available anymore was just a rumor. And true, it was a rumor that they started themselves with a technical glitch, but still, calm down, everyone. Ross and Rachel and the rest of the gang will be on Netflix for another year as they just extended the deal to keep it around. At first, it just seemed the angst was just delayed for, what, 1 year? But now it seems Warner Media will be happy to keep Friends on Netflix, just not on an exclusive basis. Now, here's the thing. Netflix is paying much more for 2019, from $30 million a year to $70 to $80 million a year. So 2019, they will be paying, let's just call it on the low ball, $70 million. That's what a library is worth.
For the rights to Friends alone, non-exclusive, perhaps, on their own streaming service. At the end of the year, Warner Media will be launching their streaming service. They are definitely going to include Friends, and apparently they will both have it. And it's possible they may both have it for years to come. But the fact that Friends is more profitable today than it was when they signed that massive deal to bring it to Netflix in the first place, when people were like, wow, $30 million a year just for reruns of a sitcom. Well, now they're, and it's still airing in syndication.
Yes,
I mean, it's not it's exclusive still on television. There. It's, yeah. It's just the only streaming service that has Friends at the moment. So the idea that they would be paying more years later for Friends, non-exclusive, that's mind-boggling. But your kids are watching it. There you go. It's like practically their number one show, apparently. People well, they binge really watch that show all the time.
Yeah, and they really want to watch Full House. Not Fuller House, but Full House. And they can't, you know, it's not anywhere that they can find
it. On Hulu.
I knew it. I knew you were going to say that. And I was like, oh, God, it's going to be on Hulu, and I don't want to pay for that service. So,
I think it's on Hulu.
I'm going to have to pay for it, I guess.
Make your kids happy. Then they can watch The Handmaid's Tale. Wait, no, don't watch that. You're kids.
It's
a lot. There's a lot of TV to watch, isn't there? So we talked about all the money being spent on content. $22 billion, $8 billion, $5 billion. Even that silly little Quibo. And in a completely related story to all that money being spent, peak TV just got peakier.
Yes, I love John Landgraf. Every year he comes out with his annual report. He's the head of FX, and at least he is now. I don't know. I guess when he moves to Disney, will he still be there? I guess so. But he has this peak TV report, and he said in 2018, there were 495 scripted TV shows. Now, this doesn't include reality shows that also use writers, by the way, to craft that reality. By the way, they use producers as writers, which is a kind of a bit of a contentious issue. But anyway, in any case, it's a record high, and it's a tad less than the 520 shows Landgraf had predicted, though.
That's right. So most of those scripted shows can be found on streaming services. That's the real news story. The number one source for TV is not TV. It's streaming services that you may watch on your laptop or your phone or your TV if you want. But it's Hulu. It's Netflix. It's Amazon Prime. That's right. When you think about TV, you should think first about streaming services. They have more shows than basic cable, and basic cable has more shows than pay cable and the traditional TV networks.
Now,
that's the headline.
But now when you're thinking about who has the biggest audience, it gets a little bit more complicated than that, because by and large, the major networks dominate week in and week out. But pay cable has monster hits like Game of Thrones, and basic cable has big audience grabbers like The Walking Dead, and streamers have big hits too, though they won't necessarily tell us how big.
Yeah, and you all should be watching Patriot. That's a cool show. The spy who writes music and sings songs, you know, that's a fun little show. So there's all these fun little shows on streaming. They're creating them. They're going to be valuable library for years to come. But yeah, they don't get the – even crappy shows on network TV get 3, 4, 5 million people a week. So that makes a big difference. So yeah, by the numbers, I know you love them. Streamers had 160 shows last year. Broadcast, almost as many, 146. Basic cable, 144. So basically, you're talking about a about 30% of all shows for each area. Streamers had about 33%, broadcast 30%, basic cable 30%, and premium cable, that's like HBO and Showtime, they had 45 shows. That's about 9%. I guess, you know, only 45 shows, but dragons don't come cheap.
No, they don't, and that's a Game of Thrones reference for those of you who don't watch.
And if you go back to 2002, the total number of scripted shows was 182. That was the year that FX launched The Shield. That's why we're happening to mention that year, because they've done such a good job of compiling all this information for everyone. So way back in 2002, all of TV shows everywhere, cable, premium cable, network, 182 shows. We've got almost that many on streaming alone today.
Wow. Well, I guess my question is, who is watching what? I mean, it's getting more complicated to find out. Music videos, they hit billions of views. Late night talk shows, they generate clips like Carpool Karaoke, which get tons of traffic on YouTube. And the list goes on. I mean, hey, Peak TV has always been difficult. It's not easy.
And that's right. I mean, it's really, you know, you think about where those eyeballs are. It isn't just those big hit shows. There is a lot of content being watched, even though Quibo thinks they've discovered the moon or something. But no, people watch these skits and sketches from SNL. They watch clips from the late night talk shows. They watch music videos. That's a lot of eyeballs watching a lot of stuff. And there's advertising on all of it.
Well, I know my co-host Michael is old. I mean, hey. Like really old, like 52 years old.
That's not old. That's like the new 30.
Sort of, but when it comes to demographics, you're no longer in the coveted 18 to 49 demo, and you sure aren't in the once coveted 18 to 34 demo. Remember when 18 to 34 was a big deal with TV advertisers? Remember that?
I do, because I'm old.
Yeah, well, that was supplanted by the broader 18 to 49 demo. Why? Why? Baby boomers. I think a baby boomer was like, hey, wait a second. I'm older than 34. It's now 18 to 49. So we have to just wait for it to like that person to like be, you know, 59, and then it'll expand.
Well, it may be happening again. I remember all they talked about was 18 to 34. That was it. That was the demo. That was the demo they wanted, and for years. And then suddenly it became 18 to 49. And that was because so many people were 35, 36, 37. So major networks still reach a broad audience, but that broad audience is getting a little smaller and a little older. This season so far, the big networks, CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, and the CW, they're down 4% in total viewers. Okay, that's all right. They reach about 32 million people a night. That's a lot of people. That's a heck of a lot more than Facebook Live and whatever show they're streaming right now. Averaged out, they're down 10% in the big demo of 18 to 49. And a couple of those networks are down 20%, almost 20%. That's a lot. And so now with fewer and fewer people in that big demo that they always talk about and fewer people watching network TV, don't be surprised if the major networks suddenly say, hey, you know what? Michael's right. An eyeball's an eyeball. Who cares what age you are? Everybody's got money to spend. We're living longer and healthier and more financially exciting lives than ever. So forget that 18 to 49 demo. We had X number of people watching, and that's the number we care about, and that's the number our advertisers should care about. I swear to you, this will happen within 5 years.
Okay. Well, hopefully
we've been saying for years they should just be eyeballs, right? Who cares if you're 17 or 37 or 54? Who cares? People have money, they can spend it. They're an audience. You want to know who you're reaching with your ad, but in terms of audience and eyeballs, that's what matters.
Well, hopefully we'll be around in 5 years to find out.
Right. We'll watch the 18 to 49 demo die a cold death.
Oh, well, since we're talking about being around and death, let's talk about some people who aren't around anymore in our obituary section.
Yeah, this is bad. A crew member died on the set of the TV show Power. That's the BET show produced by 50 Cent. And this was a 63-year-old production assistant, Pedro Jimenez, who was struck by a vehicle when placing traffic cones on a street for a shoot in Brooklyn at 4:20 in the morning. We don't really have any information. It wasn't a stunt gone awry or anything like that. It just looks like a tragic accident. Whatever safeguards and measures they should have taken, maybe we'll find out something was missing. There's a lesson to be learned. And if so, we'll change what, you know, the way this is done. But you know what? Making movies is a dangerous job. It's very sad that someone should lose their life over it, but a sad day on the set of Power.
Well, Tony-winning actor Philip Bosco died at the age of 88. He won his Tony for Lend Me a Tenor, which was a farce. He starred in over 50 Broadway shows, including 1994's An Inspector Calls. And
Saw it.
Yeah, okay. And 1995's The Heiress with Cherry Jones.
Saw it.
2000's Copenhagen.
Saw it. Great shows, all of them. He was terrific.
He didn't really have many good roles in good films. Working Girl and Bill Murray's Quick Change and Three Men and a Baby. He was on Damages, which was on TV.
Yeah, but he's a terrific actor, Tony winner, Philip Bosco, lived a great life. I was so lucky to be able to see him multiple times on stage, though I never did see Lend Me a Tenor. That was before my time. That's supposed to be a fun show, but I'm sorry to say he's gone. Also sorry to say Pete Shelley is dead. He's the lead singer of the Buzzcocks. They were one of a million punk bands launched in the wake of the Sex Pistols. In fact, if you saw that movie, 24-Hour Party People, he's sort of featured in the film. Like, they helped put on a festival that the Sex Pistols played at, and after that festival, that's when the Buzzcocks formed. In the wake of that show, they're like, we want to do a band. So the Buzzcocks were very cool. Think Green Day, sort of. They had songs like Orgasm Addict, Harmony in My Head, and Ever Fallen in Love with Someone, which was covered by the Fine Young Cannibals. They had a big hit with that. And they're kind of cool. Very DIY, which is very punk. Their first album was self-released because they wanted to self-release it. They had a classic compilation, which was their first U.S. album, I think, their first proper release. Singles Going Steady. That's when I first started listening to them. And to top it off, Pete Shelley was fluid, sexually fluid. God bless him. His 1981 solo hit was the gayish tune Homo Sapien, which was banned by the BBC. And I remember hearing that song on the radio or seeing the video on MTV and going, no, wait, what? What does he say? He kept saying he was Homo sapien, but it sounded like he was saying something else. So that was a big, you know, wall breaker, barrier, knocking down some barriers. So they're a very cool band. He was bisexual, not gay. And he typically used gender non-specific language to make his songs universal, much like Boy George would do with Culture Club. So the Buzzcocks were a very cool band.
I wonder what happened to Fine Young Cannibals. Whatever happened to them?
Well, he had a fine, you know, they had their fine little run, you know, it's better than most. They had a hit song, Ever Fallen in Love with Someone, you know, people don't usually have 30, 40 year careers in music. That's a very unusual thing. So, you know, the run they had was pretty damn good.
Well,
they disbanded in the 90s, of course. And I think Roland Gift tried to tour under the name of the band later. But their time had passed.
Well, our time. Well, it hasn't passed, but it's up for this week. And remember, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Helps other people find the show, too. You can find those ways to subscribe to us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us and email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found, well, every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael? What website can we find you on?
This week it's brothercanyouspareadime.com. God bless you, sir. God bless you.
I'm sure that's actually a website. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you can also check out bookfilter.com, where you can learn what books you should be reading. When I'm not hanging out with my new besties, BTS, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.
Well, I'll see you at New Year's Eve. Very exciting, but no kissing.